Events, issues in the news. Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Tim Mak, Senior Congressional Correspondent for the Daily Beast, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV. And here are the issues. The Trump administration issued a revised ban on immigration from six Muslim-majority nations, insisting without evidence that this was necessary to protect the United States from terrorists. The White House also endorsed a new health care proposal, but faced a series of challenges from Republicans as well as Democrats. WikiLeaks released another torrent of purloined information, this time on the ways in which the CIA can spy on individual cell phones and other electronic devices. And finally, North Korea fired a barrage of missiles into the Sea of Japan in a simultaneous launch meant to show that it could defeat anti-missile defenses. This occurred as South Korea began to deploy a U.S. defensive system, and the president of South Korea was impeached. Abdurrahim, lots to talk about. This week we're going to start with the new ban, which is very similar in many ways to the old ban. It's already being challenged by Washington State, Hawaii, a couple of other states in the courts. Is it going to survive? And if so, what would it do?
Well, first thing to note is that Iraq is no longer obviously part of that list. And that's the first question that rises. If about a month ago, if Iraq was on the list, what has changed in Iraq, or what has changed about the people planning to come from Iraq to the United States? As you said, several states now are planning to challenge the ban. What I find noteworthy about it, obviously there are some differences, and especially if you listen to the Trump administration, they say they are fundamental differences. There's a lot of disagreement about how fundamental they are. But what I find noteworthy is that obviously the first time around, there was a lot of popular mobilization at airports. That was understandable, particularly that it seemed to have come out of nowhere. This time, it's giving people a little bit more time until it doesn't kick into effect.
It's not automatic the way it was the last time, which caused total chaos.
But the level of mobilization this time around doesn't seem to be approaching the level of mobilization against it the first time around. But it's still too early days.
Yeah, I mean, we do have the court challenges, which I think are very important.
Yeah. But in terms of people actually taking to the streets, going to airports, we haven't begun to see anything approaching what we saw the first time
Well, of course, you don't have people who are arriving and suddenly being told that they can't enter the United States because of the lag time.
Yes.
So I would say if it actually goes into effect, you know, it might be something different.
Yeah.
Also, people have warnings, so they're not getting on the planes to begin with.
Exactly. Right? I mean, I would say that if there's a fundamental difference between the first time around and the second time around, it is that. The first time around, people were given absolutely no warning.
Right.
Even people who actually got flights to come to the United States, they didn't know that when they arrive, there would be a ban. This time it's different. It doesn't kick into effect until the 16th. So we'll see what happens with the challenges in the courts. But the thrill is gone, it seems to me, even from the side of the administration. The level of aggressiveness that we are seeing this time around perhaps does not match the level of aggressiveness that we saw a few weeks ago.
Now, Tim, this whole thing was put forward as something that was absolutely essential for U.S. national security. And when it was the second version was rolled out, I think it was Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, made some claim about 300 immigrants, or refugees rather, under investigation by the FBI for terrorism. He didn't say if any of those people had ever been charged with anything or if any of them came from the countries that were listed in the ban. So what do you think of the national security argument for this measure?
Well, we still remain a country where you're innocent until proven guilty in the court of law, which is something the Attorney General should know as the Attorney General of the United States. But furthermore, it's been clear through the first travel ban and the second travel ban that this administration is intent on demonizing immigrants. And if you listen to the State of the Union that the president delivered not long ago, he indicated a desire to open an office that would publicize immigrant crimes.
Well, crimes committed by, was it immigrants or illegal aliens?
It would be illegal immigrants or undocumented.
Undocumented, okay, because that's something different, right?
Although traditional statistics, historical statistics have shown that immigrants commit crimes at a lower level than naturalized citizenry, oftentimes because these are folks who want to come here, who have fought to come here,
exactly.
Who wish to be here and want to succeed and work hard and survive.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the mood in Washington is a lot more muted in response to the second travel ban than the first travel ban. And objectively, regardless of what you believe of the entire concept of the travel ban, it is objectively less egregious than the original travel ban, which felt and was, I think, if you read it through, was an attack on immigration itself.
Yeah, well, it also, it didn't make clear that green card holders were,
exactly.
were not included, dual nationals. It was
people
quite,
with visas had them torn from their passports.
Right,
people
it
were
was
being
quite
sent
traumatic.
Back on planes.
Yeah.
Green card holders who had been here for years and had fought for their rightful place in American society were now concerned about whether they would still be able to remain in America,
yeah.
you know, which is green cards are for permanent residency. Yeah. And so you imagine that means permanent
residency.
So there was so much confusion, and especially among communities where you're likely to know an immigrant, there was this very deep-seated feeling of outrage, of who are you to say that my friend doesn't belong here? That, some of which has been alleviated by this second travel ban, which makes it more clear that those with visas can keep their visas and that merely they will stop issuing visas to these countries. But one other problem with it is that it still maintains a total shutdown in refugee flow.
Pretty much, yeah. It sets a cap of 50,000, and apparently 37,000 have already come in, so they're just a small number that can
And what's problematic about that, beyond kind of America's history of welcoming refugees, is also it shuts down the Special Immigrant Visa Program, which is the program for translators and other folks in Iraq and Afghanistan who have risked their lives to help American troops abroad and can then thereafter be sponsored for refugee status in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's all gone. So there are any number of elements that are still objectionable to this travel ban, the mm-hmm. second version of the travel ban, but you have to see, even just by the reaction in the streets, that it is less objectionable than it was.
Well, again, you know, the reason people rushed to the airports was because there was chaos at the airports and people were being detained and so on. This was, you know, the last few days, there have also been women's marches. There are marches for all sorts of reasons. I think that the legal challenge is probably more important. The argument I think that the lawyers and many of them are making is that the campaign statements of the Trump administration, I mean, Trump called for a ban on Muslims entering the United States. He did that during the campaign. And his aides have also referred at various times to Muslim bans. And since these countries are majority Muslim countries, the argument will still be that there is a religious test being now put on admission to the United States. So I think that's the constitutional ground on which it will rise or fall.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I do remember that during the controversy over the first ban, initially, there were some questions about whether the courts would admit the notion that there was intent.
Mm-hmm.
He may have badly explained, or the ban may have badly explained, why those people were prevented from coming into the United States. But the fact that candidate Trump, during the campaign, talked about wanting to stop Muslims, that obviously gave ammunition to those who thought that the courts should admit intent in making the decision. And for them, that was obviously a victory. So now they have that, but they also have the first successful challenge to the ban, which
right.
also becomes part of the arsenal.
Sure, becomes a
in
precedent.
In their hands. Exactly.
Right, right. And they can also still argue that there are financial losses to states, for example, from students who won't come, people who won't come to scientific conferences, a lot of disruptions as well. Tim, of course, this Muslim ban, visa ban, immigration ban, whatever you want to call it, was one of Trump's campaign promises. And another campaign promise he made was to repeal and replace Obamacare, as the Affordable Care Act is known, the health care system that was passed under Obama. So this is the week that they unveiled their plan. I think it's called the American Care Act.
Healthcare Act,
right? Although some people are now calling it Trump Care, or they're calling it Obamacare 2.0, or I think one columnist called it Obamacare 0.5 as half of what Obamacare provided. So how would you regard it? And what's been the reaction, particularly from Republicans, to this legislation?
So Republicans, as we've talked about many times on this program over the last 5-6 years, have been outraged at the passage of Obamacare in 2009 and have spent the last 8 years trying to rail against it and promising that they would repeal it. Now that they have the control of the House of Representatives and the Senate and the White House, they have an opportunity to do so. However, the Ryan Care or the Trump Care or whatever you want to call it nowadays maintains many of the core provisions of Obamacare. Many of the popular portions of it remain in place. For example, one of the very popular provisions was, hey, if you're under 26, you can remain on your parents' health care plan. Mm-hmm. That's very popular. That they're going to keep that. One of the very important core tenets of Obamacare was, if you have a pre-existing condition, health insurers cannot deny you coverage. Mm-hmm. Trump Care or Ryan Care will keep that.
Ryan as in Paul Ryan, the Speaker
Paul
of the
Ryan,
House.
Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House. So what does Ryan Care actually do? One of the major concepts behind health insurance is we need to get a pool of individuals that are healthy to reduce the prices of covering health care for the very ill. So how do you do that? Obamacare said we're going to have what's called an individual mandate. Everyone in America must buy health insurance. And that way, healthy people will pay into a system that subsidizes sick people. Mm-hmm. But the Ryan Care or Trump Care system, what that does is it makes it optional. It makes healthy people are not required to pay for health insurance. And if they get sick, they have to pay a penalty to get back into health care. What's that going to do? That's going to desperately increase the price of healthcare across America because healthy people will not pay for health insurance unless they get sick.
We should say also that this bill that's been introduced has not been scored by the Congressional Budget Office, so we don't really know what it would cost in terms of deficits and things like that. And that's a little irregular, isn't it, in Congress?
Well, yes. And one of the many criticisms that Republicans had of Obamacare was that it also was passed without a proper estimate from the Congressional Budget Office. All of which to say is Republicans have presented this proposal and its conservative base is angry. They have spent years railing against Obamacare and now they are given Obamacare Lite or Obamacare 2.0 and they're very dissatisfied about it.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor, and joining me today are Abdurrahim Fukar of Al Jazeera and Tim Mack of The Daily Beast. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Abdurrahim, of course, the Democrats don't like this either. They point to the fact that in many cases it is really a tax cut for the rich that's been kind of prepackaged as a new healthcare proposal. But one of the ways that the Obama administration financed the healthcare proposal was with a surcharge on people who earned a certain amount of money and so on. And all of those sort of tax increases on the rich are now gone.
I mean, the feeling I get is that the Democrats are probably repeating the original wrinkle with the Republicans. The Republicans initially, several years ago, when Obama came up with the idea, opposed it not because they were convinced that it didn't make economic sense. They refused it. They rejected it for ideological reasons. And it seems to me that given the frenzy among Trump's supporters, his base, now about the promise that he made during the campaign that he would repeal it or get rid of it or reform it or whatever, the Republicans have to be seen to be doing something, whether that makes economic sense or not. And I suppose that if you have the power to shove it through, you can't shove it through and continue to argue, because this is not an exact science. You continue to argue, no, this is what we did and what we did is better than what Obama did. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that we'll have to wait until 2018 to begin to get a real sense of what they've actually done if they do push it through.
If they push it through. One other point on this, Tim, and that is that the bill would phase out the ability of states to be reimbursed for Medicaid costs. These are the costs for the very poor and people who are on disabilities, who have mental health problems and so on. And it'll be interesting to see what the Republican governors have to say about that, given that many of them accepted this so-called Medicaid expansion. And these are also, many of them, people who voted for Trump, right?
Right. You know, there are plenty of voters in lower income brackets who voted for Donald Trump. And this, sadly, is not going to be a proposal that benefits their lives, especially if they're sick. This proposal, for example, replaces Obamacare's subsidies for the poor and makes it based on age instead. So whether you're wealthy or you're poor, these subsidies will be based on age, which is a handout to the rich. And
well, I think it gets phased out if you're very wealthy. But right.
But generally speaking, we're not talking billionaires here. We're talking normal people.
We're
talking your average individual. So it's very hard to look at this proposal as anything other than a real punch in the gut for the poor.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to turn to another topic which has popped up in recent days. And it's interesting, whenever sort of the president is in trouble over something, WikiLeaks, Abdurrahim, seems to come out with a new trove of documents. In this case, they're documents about the CIA, which is an agency that Trump has not been overly fond of. The first reaction is sort of to say, you know, like Inspector Renault in the old movie Casablanca, I am shocked that the CIA is spying on people. Well, of course, that's what the CIA does. But this is kind of a compendium of all the various hacking tools that the CIA apparently employs to try to do its spying overseas, we should say, not in the United States. How big a deal is this?
I think it's a very big deal. Incidentally, several days before the leak was made by WikiLeaks, people on WhatsApp were sending out messages saying, be careful using WhatsApp, the government or whoever may be able to actually spy on what you're saying. And these are
encrypted.
Encrypted. These are messages coming from outside the United States, from the Middle East, from Latin America, from various other parts of the world. I think that, you know, the importance of the recent wave of leaks goes in so many different directions. Obviously, the obvious one is obviously us normal citizens, wherever we may be in the United States or elsewhere in the world. The idea, although we know that spying agencies, that's what they do. They spy on people and things. But the idea that there is almost no refuge left. You could be watching television and being spied on. You could be using your phone and being spied on. That's a very, very unsettling notion. And then there's the other dimension, you alluded to it. President Trump has not been very fond of the CIA and other spying agencies. 17 of them had told him that Vladimir Putin had tried to spy on his campaign and maybe even helped his campaign win the election, something that he denies. And then he gets this leak, and it's almost vindication to him that his feeling about the spying agencies in the United States was right from the beginning. But the flip side of the coin is that if you are the president of the United States, you obviously have to watch out for the national security of the United States. And this dump of leaks comes on your watch.
Right.
What are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
And in what way your critics also feel vindicated when they say that the Russians had spied on you means that there were holes, gaps, which in the national security of the United States, which the Russians had taken advantage of, according to your critics. So I think it works for him, but at the same time, it also works against him.
Yeah. Well, Tim, it also, it feeds this sort of moral equivalency between the United States and Russia that Trump has put forward. You know, they hack, we hack, right? At the same time, WikiLeaks did not release the source codes for these various techniques of hacking.
Yet.
And apparently they're now saying that they're going to the various companies like Apple and Google and so on, telling them what these vulnerabilities are so that these companies can fix them. So now WikiLeaks is trying to show that it's actually being a good global citizen. Some reports have suggested these are old vulnerabilities that have all been fixed. You're a young person and therefore more tech savvy than Abdurrahim or me. So what do you make of it?
Okay, what is encryption? When I send a message and I say hello to you, from me to you through an encrypted app, what happens? The text gets scrambled up against an encryption code, and then it gets sent to you, where it's descrambled, and it comes out as hello. That's what WhatsApp does, and that's what Whisper does,
and
that's
Telegram.
What many of the other apps that folks use for encrypted messaging does. Mm-hmm. Now, the CIA has not broken that process. That process is a mathematical process, one that takes thousands of years of computing power to actually solve. Mm-hmm. Even the word hello encrypted, okay? That's not the issue here. The issue here is that the CIA has supposedly been able to infiltrate your phone
device, yeah.
and your device before it gets encrypted and finds the information before it's encrypted and sent to you. If you look at it that way, encryption is totally useless if someone is looking at your screen.
Right.
you're typing it in.
Right.
And so that's the situation that the CIA has designed in order to get away, get around the problem of encryption.
Yeah. Now, these leaks apparently came from contractors, right? So here we go again. I mean, we've had Edward Snowden. We've had various contractors for intelligence agencies who just walk away with all this information.
There's been a criminal investigation that has been launched into this. It is not an easy thing to get information off top secret servers, and not an easy thing to do it in mass quantities without being noticed. When you do something in the electronic world, there are trails, there are tracks, and it's going to be very difficult to hide, I think.
Yeah. All right. We're going to turn now to our final topic and talking about crises that could emerge in the early days of the Trump administration. Certainly right up there is North Korea, Abdur-Rahim. And there have been so many developments regarding the North Koreans and the South Koreans in recent days. I think it's worth a little time. The North Koreans shot, I think it was four missiles simultaneously into the Sea of Japan. They weren't particularly sophisticated missiles, but their ability to fire them all at once has caught people's attention. What are the North Koreans? I mean, obviously, they're trying to show that they can defeat anti-missile defenses, perhaps, get the world's attention. What do you make of that?
I think they're certainly trying to send the new president of the United States a message, in addition to messages to their neighbors, such as Japan, and the Japanese and the South Koreans are obviously very nervous about what the North Koreans are sending as a message. But I think for the North Korean leader, this is definitely his own way of telling Donald Trump, look, I'm here, this is what I can do. And, you know, if you can test the resolve of a new administration in its early days, it's always better. Mm-hmm. And he's doing that. The problem is, what are you going to do about it? And this administration is trying to do things about it. It's trying to reinforce, for example, the defenses of South Korea, number one.
And they're holding military maneuvers, which is something probably maybe the reason for the missile launches, since North Korea always complains about these maneuvers.
But obviously, your main key to dealing with North Korea, if you're the United States, as it has been all these years, is China. And to this point in time, the Chinese have sent some confusing signals about North Korea, the issue of deciding to suspend purchases of coal from North Korea. But at the same time, the Chinese are obviously have always been extremely worried about destabilizing North Korea because it would have implications for China. So Trump cannot deal with North Korea, even if he has allies in the region, such as South Korea and Japan. He has to go through China. And I'm not sure at this particular point in time what the level of real friction between the Chinese and the North Korean leader. There has been talk about some friction, but I'm not sure if it's tactical or strategic in the relations between China and North Korea.
Now, Tim, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, is going to East Asia to talk about North Korea, presumably. At the same time, South Korea is in a bit of political chaos, and its hardline president, President Park, has just been impeached, and they're due for elections, and it's possible that someone who has a more dovish attitude toward North Korea might be elected, which could put them at odds with the United States, yeah?
Well, when Donald Trump took office, it's now been reported that one thing that President Obama told him that would be his number one national security crisis that he'd have to deal with immediately would be North Korea. And that's not something you'd expect for a country that is actively engaged in war in various countries in the Middle East. But there you have it. It's a real serious threat where millions of lives are on the line. And there is incredible regional instability there. What's happening in South Korea is, I think, actually a healthy sign of a democracy and institutions that are working, people protesting in the streets.
Yeah. And remind us why President Park was impeached. It was because of a scandal involving a close friend, right?
Yes, it involved corruption. And folks in the street demonstrated in the thousands and eventually succeeded or are succeeding. And I see that as a healthy sign of democracy in contrast to what's happening in North Korea.
Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tim Mak, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast, and Abdurrahim Fukar, Washington bureau chief for Al Jazeera. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA.